Thank you. Try this one. What lies in bed and stands in bed, first white, then red, the plumper it gets, the better the old woman likes it. Eddie burst out laughing. A dork, he yelled. Crude, Roland, but I like it, I like it. Roland shook his head. Your answer is wrong. A good riddle is sometimes a puzzle in words, like Jake's about the river, but sometimes it's more like a magician's trick, making you look in one direction while it's going somewhere else. It's a double, Jake said. He explained what Aaron Deepnow had said about the riddle of Samson. Roland nodded. Is it a strawberry? Susanna asked, then answered her own question. Of course it is. It's like the fire riddle. There's a metaphor hidden inside it. Once you understand the metaphor, you can solve the riddle. I metaphor sex, but she slapped my face and walked away when I asked, Eddie told them sadly. They all ignored him. If you change gets to grows, Susanna went on, it's easy. First white, then red, plump it grows, the better the old woman likes it. She looked pleased with herself. Roland nodded. The answer I always heard was a wenberry, but I'm sure both answers mean the same thing. Eddie picked up Riddledy-Dum and began flipping through it. How about this one, Roland? When is a door not a door? Roland frowned. Is it another piece of your stupidity? Because my patience... No, I promise to take it seriously, and I am. I'm trying, at least. It's in this book, and I just happen to know the answer. I heard it when I was a kid. Jake, who also knew the answer, winked at Eddie. Eddie winked back, and was amused to see Oi also trying to wink. The bumbler kept shutting both eyes and eventually gave up. Roland and Susanna, meanwhile, were puzzling over the question. It must have something to do with love, Roland said. A door, a door. When is a door not a door? Oi said. His imitation of Roland's thoughtful tone was perfect. Eddie winked at Jake again. Jake covered his mouth to hide a smile. Is the answer false love? Roland asked at last. Nope. Window, Susanna said suddenly and decisively. When is a door not a door? When it's a window. Nope. Eddie was grinning broadly now, but Jake was struck by how far from the real answer both of them had wandered. There was magic at work here, he thought. Pretty common stuff as magic went, no flying carpets or disappearing elephants, but magic all the same. He suddenly saw what they were doing, a simple game of riddles around a campfire, in an entirely new light. It was like playing blind man's bluff, only in this game the blindfold was made of words. I give up, Susanna said. Yes, Roland said. Tell if you know. The answer is a jar. A door is not a door when it's a jar. Get it? Eddie watched as comprehension dawned on Roland's face and asked a little apprehensively, Is it a bad one? I was trying to be serious this time, Roland, really. Not bad at all. On the contrary, it's quite good. Court would have gotten it, I'm sure, probably Alain, too. It's still very clever. I did what I always used to do in the schoolroom, made it more complicated than it really was, and shot right past the answer. There really is something to it, isn't there? Eddie mused. Roland nodded, but Eddie didn't see. He was looking into the depths of the fire, where dozens of roses bloomed and faded in the coals. Roland said, One more and we'll turn in. Only from tonight on we'll stand a watch. You first, Eddie, then Susanna. I'll take the last one.
What about me? Jake asked.
Later on you may have to take a turn. Right now it's more important for you to get your sleep.
Do you really think sentry duty is necessary? Susanna asked.
I don't know, and that's the best reason of all to do it. Jake, choose us a riddle from your book. Eddie handed Riddledy-Dum to Jake, who thumbed through the pages and finally stopped near the back.
Whoa, this one's a killer.
Let's hear it, Eddie said. If I don't get it, Suze will. We're known at fair days all across the land as Eddie Dean and his riddling queen.
We're witty tonight, ain't we? Susanna said. Let's see how witty you are after sitting by the side of the road until midnight or so, honey child.
Jake read,
There is a thing that nothing is, and yet it has a name. It's sometimes tall and sometimes short, joins our talks, joins our sport, and plays at every game. They discussed this riddle for almost 15 minutes, but none of them could even hazard an answer. "Maybe it'll come to one of us while we're asleep," Jake said. "That's how I got the one about the river."
"Cheap book with the answers torn out," Eddie said. He stood up and wrapped a hide blanket around his shoulders like a cloak.
"Well, it was cheap. Mr. Tower gave it to me for free."
"What am I looking for, Roland?" Eddie asked.
Roland shrugged as he lay down. "I don't know. But I think you'll know it if you see it or hear it."
"Wake me up when you start feeling sleepy," Susanna said.
"You better believe it."
4. A grassy ditch ran along the side of the road, and Eddie sat on the far side of it with his blanket around his shoulders. A thin scud of clouds had veiled the sky tonight, dimming the star show. A strong west wind was blowing. When Eddie turned his face in that direction, he could clearly smell the buffalo which now owned these plains, a mixed perfume of hot fur and fresh dung. The clarity which had returned to his senses in these last few months was amazing, and at times like these a little spooky as well. Very faintly he could hear a buffalo calf bawling. He turned toward the city, and after a while he began to think he might be seeing distant sparks of light there, the electric candles of the twin story. But he was well aware that he might be seeing nothing more than his own wishful thinking.
"You're a long way from 42nd Street, sweetheart. Hope is a great thing, no matter what anyone says, but don't hope so hard you lose sight of that one thought. You're a long way from 42nd Street. That's not New York up ahead, no matter how much you might wish it was. That's Ludd, and it'll be whatever it is. And if you keep that in mind, maybe you'll be okay."
He passed his time on watch trying to think of an answer to the last riddle of the evening. The scolding Roland had given him about his dead baby joke had left him feeling disgruntled, and it would please him to be able to start off the morning by giving them a good answer. Of course, they wouldn't be able to check any answer against the back of the book, but he had an idea that with good riddles, a good answer was usually self-evident. Sometimes tall and sometimes short. He thought that was the key, and all the rest was probably just misdirection. What was sometimes tall and sometimes short? Pants? No, pants were sometimes short and sometimes long, but he never heard of tall pants. Tails? Like pants that only fit snugly one way. Drinks were sometimes both tall and short. Order, he murmured, and thought for a moment that he must have stumbled across the solution. Both adjectives fit the noun glove tight. A tall order was a big job. A short order was something you got on the quick in a restaurant, a hamburger or a tuna melt. Except that tall orders and tuna melts didn't join our talk or play at every game. He felt a rush of frustration and had to smile at himself, getting all wound up about a harmless word game in a kid's book. All the same, he found it a little easier to believe that people might really kill each other over riddles, if the stakes were high enough and cheating was involved. Let it go. You're doing exactly what Roland said, thinking right past it. Still, what else did he have to think about? Then the drumming from the city began again, and he did have something else. There was no build-up. At one moment it wasn't there, and at the next it was going full force, as if a switch had been turned. Eddie walked to the edge of the road, turned toward the city, and listened. After a few moments he looked around to see if the drums had awakened the others, but he was still alone. He turned toward Ludd again and cupped his ears forward with the sides of his hands. Boom, papa, boom, papa, boom, 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 papa, boom, papa, boom, 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 boom. Eddie became more and more sure that he had been right about what it was, that he had at least solved this riddle. Boom, baba, boom, baba, boom, ba, boom, boom. The idea that he was standing by a deserted road in an almost empty world, standing some 170 miles from a city which had been built by some fabulous lost civilization and listening to a rock and roll drum line, that was crazy. But was it any crazier than a traffic light that dinged and dropped a rusty green flag with the word GO printed on it? Any crazier than discovering the wreck of a German plane from the 1930s? Eddie sang the words to the ZZ Top song in a whisper.
You need just enough of that sticky stuff to hold the seams in your fine blue jeans to say yeah, yeah.
They fit the beat perfectly. It was the disco pulse percussion of Velcro Fly. Eddie was sure of it. A short time later the sound ceased as suddenly as it had begun, and he could hear only the wind, and more faintly the Send River, which had a bed but never slept. Five. The next 4 days were uneventful. They walked, they watched the bridge and the city grow larger and define themselves more clearly. They camped, they ate, they riddled, they kept watch turn and turn about. Jake had pestered Roland into letting him keep a short watch in the 2 hours just before dawn. They slept. The only remarkable incident had to do with the bees. Around noon on the 3rd day after the discovery of the downed plane, a buzzing sound came to them, growing louder and louder until it dominated the day. At last Roland stopped. "There," he said, and pointed toward a grove of eucalyptus trees. "It sounds like bees," Susanna said. Roland's faded blue eyes gleamed. "Could be we'll have a little dessert tonight." "I don't know how to tell you this, Roland," Eddie said, "but I have this aversion to being stung." "Don't we all?" Roland agreed. "But the day is windless. I think we can smoke them to sleep and steal their comb right out from under them without setting half the world on fire. Let's have a look." He carried Susanna, who was as eager for the adventure as the gunslinger himself, toward the grove. Eddie and Jake lagged behind, and Oi, apparently having decided that discretion was the better part of valor, remained sitting at the edge of the great road, panting like a dog and watching them carefully. Roland paused at the edge of the trees. "Stay where you are," he told Eddie and Jake, speaking softly. "We're going to have a look. I'll give you a come-on if all's well." He carried Susanna into the dappled shadows of the grove, while Eddie and Jake remained in the sunshine, peering after them. It was cooler in the shade. The buzzing of the bees was a steady, hypnotic drone. "There are too many," Roland murmured. "This is late summer. They should be out working. I don't..." He caught sight of the hive, bulging tumorously from the hollow of a tree in the center of the clearing, and broke off.
"What's the matter with them?"
Susanna asked, in a soft, horrified voice.
"Roland, what's the matter with them?"
A bee, as plump and slow-moving as a horsefly in October, droned past her head. Susanna flinched away from it. Roland motioned for the others to join them. They did, and stood looking at the hive without speaking. The chambers weren't neat hexagons, but random holes of all shapes and sizes. The beehive itself looked queerly melted, as if someone had turned a blowtorch on it. The bees which crawled sluggishly over it were as white as snow. "No honey tonight," Roland said. "What we took from yonder comb might taste sweet, but it would poison us as surely as night follows day." One of the grotesque white bees lumbered heavily past Jake's head. He ducked away with an expression of loathing.
"What did it?" Eddie asked. "What did it to them, Roland?"
"The same thing that has emptied this whole land. The thing that's still causing many of the buffalo to be born as sterile freaks. I've heard it called the Old War, the Great Fire, the Cataclysm, and the Great Poisoning. Whatever it was the start of all our troubles, and it happened long ago. 1,000 years before the great-great-grandfathers of the river-crossing folk were born. The physical effects, the two-headed buffalo and the white bees and such, have grown less as time passes. I've seen this for myself. The other changes are greater, if harder to see, and they are still going on." They watched the white bees crawl, dazed and almost completely helpless about their hive. Some were apparently trying to work. Most simply wandered about, butting heads and crawling over one another. Eddie found himself remembering a news clip he'd seen once. It had shown a crowd of survivors leaving the area where a gas main had exploded, flattening almost a whole city block in some California town. These bees reminded him of those dazed, shell-shocked survivors.
"You had a nuclear war, didn't you?" he asked, almost accused. "These great old ones you like to talk about, they blew their great old asses straight to hell, didn't they?"
"I don't know what happened. No one knows. The records of those times are lost, and the few stories are confused and conflicting."
"Let's get out of here," Jake said in a trembling voice. "Looking at those things makes me sick."
"I'm with you, sugar," Susanna said.
So they left the bees to their aimless, shattered life in the grove of ancient trees. and there was no honey that night. Six.
When are you going to tell us what you do know? Eddie asked the next morning. The day was bright and blue, but there was a bite in the air. Their first autumn in this world was almost upon them.
Roland glanced at him. What do you mean?
I'd like to hear your whole story, from beginning to end, starting with Gilead. How you grew up there and what happened to end it all. I want to know how you found out about the Dark Tower and why you started chasing after it in the first place. I want to know about your first bunch of friends, too, and what happened to them.
Roland removed his hat, armed sweat from his brow, then replaced it. You have the right to know all those things, I suppose, and I'll tell them to you, but not now. It's a very long story. I never expected to tell it to anyone, and I'll only tell it once.
When?
Eddie persisted. When the time is right, Roland said, and with that they had to be content. 7. Roland came awake the moment before Jake began to shake him. He sat up and looked around, but Eddie and Susanna were still fast asleep, and in the first faint light of morning he could see nothing amiss.
What is it? He asked Jake in a low voice.
I don't know. Fighting, maybe. Come and listen.
Roland threw his blanket aside and followed Jake out to the road. He reckoned they were now only 3 days' walk from the place where the Send passed in front of the city, and the bridge, built squarely along the path of the beam, dominated the horizon. Its pronounced tilt was more clearly visible than ever, and he could see at least a dozen gaps where overstressed cables had snapped like the strings of a lyre. Tonight the wind blew directly into their faces as they looked toward the city, and the sounds it carried to them were faint but clear.
Is it fighting?
Jake asked. Roland nodded and held a finger to his lips. He heard faint shouts, a crash that sounded like some huge object falling, and, of course, the drums. Now there was another crash, this one more musical, the sound of breaking glass.
Jeepers,
Jake whispered and moved closer to the gunslinger. Then came the sounds which Roland had hoped not to hear, a fast, sandy rattle of small arms fire, followed by a loud, hollow bang, clearly an explosion of some kind. It rolled across the flatlands toward them like an invisible bowling ball. After that, the shouts, thuds, and sounds of breakage quickly sank below the level of the drums, and when the drums quit a few minutes later with their usual unsettling suddenness, the city was silent again. But now that silence had an unpleasant waiting quality. Roland put an arm around Jake's shoulders. Still not too late to detour around, he said. Jake glanced up at him.
We can't.
Because of the train? Jake nodded and sing-songed,
Blaine is a pain, but we have to take the train. And the city's the only place where we can get on.
Roland looked thoughtfully at Jake. Why do you say we have to? Is it Ka? Because, Jake, you have to understand that you don't know much about Ka yet. It's the sort of subject men study all their lives.
I don't know if it's Ka or not, but I do know that we can't go into the wastelands unless we're protected, and that means Blaine. Without him, we'll die, like those bees we saw are going to die when winter comes. We have to be protected, because the wastelands are poison.
How do you know these things?
I don't know, Jake said, almost angrily. I just do.
All right, Roland said mildly. He looked toward Lud again. But we'll have to be damned careful. It's unlucky that they still have gunpowder. If they have that, they may have things that are even more powerful. I doubt if they know how to use them, but that only increases the danger. They could get excited and blow us all to hell. Hell! A grave voice said from behind them. They glanced around and saw Oi sitting by the side of the road watching them. 8. Later that day, they came to a new road which swept toward them out of the west and joined their own way. Beyond this point, the great road, now much wider and split down the middle by a median divider of some polished dark stone, began to sink. and the crumbling concrete embankments which rose on either side of them gave the pilgrims a claustrophobic, trapped feeling. They stopped at a point where one of these concrete dikes had been broken open, affording a comforting line of sight to the open land beyond, and ate a light, unsatisfying meal. "Why do you think they dropped the road down like this, Eddie?" Jake asked. "I mean, someone did do it this way on purpose, didn't they?" Eddie looked through the break in the concrete where the flat land stretched on as smoothly as ever and nodded. "Then why?"
"Dunno, champ," Eddie said, but he thought he did. He glanced at Roland and guessed that he knew, too.
The sunken road leading to the bridge had been a defensive measure. Troops placed atop the concrete slopes were in control of two carefully engineered redoubts. If the defenders didn't like the look of the folks approaching Ludd along the Great Road, they could rain destruction down on them.
"You sure you don't know?" Jake asked.
Eddie smiled at Jake and tried to stop imagining that there was some nut up there right now getting ready to roll a large rusty bomb down one of those decayed concrete ramps.
"No idea," he said.
Susanna whistled disgustedly between her teeth.
"This road's going to hell, Roland. I was hoping we were done with that damn harness, but you better get it out again."
He nodded and rummaged in his purse for it without a word. The condition of the great road deteriorated as other smaller roads joined it like tributaries joining a great river. As they neared the bridge, the cobbles were replaced with a surface Roland thought of as metal and the rest of them thought of as asphalt or hot top. It had not held up as well as the cobbles. Time had done some damage. The passage of countless horses and wagons since the last repairs were made had done more. The surface had been chewed into a treacherous rubble. Foot travel would be difficult, and the idea of pushing Susanna's wheelchair over that crumbled surface was ridiculous. The banks on either side had grown steadily steeper, and now, at their tops, they could see slim, pointed shapes looming against the sky. Roland thought of arrowheads, huge ones, weapons made by a tribe of giants. To his companions, they looked like rockets or guided missiles. Susanna thought of redstones fired from Cape Canaveral. Eddie thought about Sam, some built to be fired from the backs of flatbed trucks stored all over Europe. Jake thought of ICBMs hiding in reinforced concrete silos under the plains of Kansas and the unpopulated mountains of Nevada, programmed to hit back at China or the USSR in the event of nuclear Armageddon. All of them felt as if they had passed into a dark and woeful zone of shadow, or into a countryside laboring under some old but still powerful curse. Some hours after they entered this area, Jake called it the Gauntlet, the concrete embankments ended at a place where half a dozen access roads drew together like the strands of a spider web, and here the land opened out again, a fact which relieved all of them, although none of them said so out loud. Another traffic light swung over the junction. This one was more familiar to Eddie, Susanna, and Jake. It had once had lenses on its four faces, although the glass had been broken out long ago.
"I'll bet this road was the eighth wonder of the world once upon a time," Susanna said. "And look at it now, it's a minefield."
"Old ways are sometimes the best ways," Roland agreed.
Eddie was pointing west. "Look." Now that the high concrete barriers were gone, they could see exactly what old Cy had described to them over cups of bitter coffee in River Crossing.
"One track only," he had said, "set up high on a column of man-made stone, such as the old ones used to make their streets and walls."
The track raced toward them out of the west in a slim, straight line, then flowed across the Send and into the city on a narrow, golden trestle. It was a simple, elegant construction, and the only one they had seen so far which was totally without rust, but it was badly marred all the same. Halfway across, a large piece of the trestle had fallen into the rushing river below. What remained were two long, jutting piers that pointed at each other like accusing fingers. Jutting out of the water below the hole was a streamlined tube of metal. Once it had been bright blue, but now the color had been dimmed by spreading scales of rust. It looked very small from this distance.
"So much for Blaine," Eddie said. "No wonder they stopped hearing it. The supports finally gave way while it was crossing the river, and it fell in the drink. It must have been decelerating when it happened, or it would have carried straight across, and all we'd see would be a big hole like a bomb crater in the far bank.
Well, it was a great idea while it lasted. Mercy said there was another one, Susanna reminded him.
Yeah, she also said she hadn't heard it in 7 or 8 years, and Aunt Talitha said it was more like 10.
What do you think, Jake?
Jake? Earth to Jake, Earth to Jake, come in, little buddy.
Jake, who had been staring intently at the remains of the train in the river, only shrugged.
You're a big help, Jake, Eddie said. Valuable input, that's why I love you, why we all love you.
Jake paid no attention. He knew what he was seeing, and it wasn't Blaine. The remains of the mono sticking out of the river were blue. In his dream, Blaine had been the dusty, sugary pink of the bubblegum you got with baseball trading cards. Roland, meanwhile, had cinched the straps of Susanna's carry harness across his chest. Eddie, boost your lady into this contraption. It's time we moved on and saw for ourselves. Jake now shifted his gaze, looking nervously toward the bridge looming ahead. He could hear a high, ghostly humming noise in the distance, the sound of the wind playing in the decayed steel hangars which connected the overhead cables to the concrete deck below.
"Do you think it'll be safe to cross?" Jake asked.
"We'll find out tomorrow," Roland replied. Nine. The next morning, Roland's band of travelers stood at the end of the long, rusty bridge, gazing across at Ludd. Eddie's dreams of wise old elves who had preserved a working technology in which the pilgrims could draw were disappearing. Now that they were this close, he could see holes in the cityscape, where whole blocks of buildings appeared to have been either burned or blasted. The skyline reminded him of a diseased jaw from which many teeth have already fallen. It was true that most of the buildings were still standing, but they had a dreary, disused look that filled Eddie with an uncharacteristic gloom. And the bridge between the travelers and that shuttered maze of steel and concrete looked anything but solid and eternal. The vertical hangars on the left sagged slackly, the ones remaining on the right almost screamed with tension. The deck had been constructed of hollow concrete boxes shaped like trapezoids. Some of these had buckled upward, displaying empty black interiors, others had slipped askew. Many of these latter had merely cracked, but others were badly broken, leaving gaps big enough to drop trucks, big trucks, into. In places where the bottoms of the box sections, as well as the tops, had shattered, they could see the muddy riverbank and the gray-green water of the Send beyond it. Eddie put the distance between the deck and the water as 300 feet at the center of the bridge, and that was probably a conservative estimate. Eddie peered at the huge concrete caissons to which the main cables were anchored, and thought the one on the right side of the bridge looked as if it had been pulled partway out of the earth. He decided he might do well not to mention this fact to the others. It was bad enough that the bridge was swaying slowly but perceptibly back and forth. Just looking at it made him feel seasick.
"Well," he asked Roland, "what do you think?"
Roland pointed to the right side of the bridge. Here was a canted walkway about 5 feet wide. It had been constructed atop a series of smaller concrete boxes and was, in effect, a separate deck. This segmented deck appeared to be supported by an under cable, or perhaps it was a thick steel rod, anchored to the main support cables by huge bow clamps. Eddie inspected the closest one with the avid interest of a man who may soon be entrusting his life to the object he is studying. The bow clamp appeared rusty but still sound. The words "Le Merc Foundry" had been stamped into its metal. Eddie was fascinated to realize he no longer knew if the words were in the high speech or in English.
"I think we can use that," Roland said. "There's only one bad place. Do you see it?"
"Yeah, it's kind of hard to miss."
The bridge, which had to be at least 3/4 of a mile long, might not have had any proper maintenance for over 1,000 years, but Roland guessed that the real destruction might have been going on for only the last 50 or so. As the hangars on the right snapped, the bridge had listed farther and farther to the left. The greatest twist had occurred in the center of the bridge between the 2 400-foot cable towers. At the place where the pressure of the twist was the greatest, a gaping, eye-shaped hole ran across the deck. The break in the walkway was narrower, but even so, at least 2 adjoining concrete box sections had fallen into the Send, leaving a gap at least 20 or 30 feet wide. Where these boxes had been, they could clearly see the rusty steel rod or cable which supported the walkway. They would have to use it to get across the gap.
"I think we can cross," Roland said, calmly pointing. "The gap is inconvenient, but the side rail is still there, so we'll have something to hold on to."
Eddie nodded, but he could feel his heart pounding hard. The exposed walkway support looked like a big pipe made of jointed steel and was probably 4 feet across at the top. In his mind's eye, he could see how they would have to edge across, feet on the broad, slightly curved back of the support, hands clutching the rail, while the bridge swayed slowly like a ship in a mild swell.
"Jesus," he said.
He tried to spit, but nothing came out. His mouth was too dry.
"You sure, Roland?"
"So far as I can see, it's the only way." Roland pointed downriver, and Eddie saw a second bridge. This one had fallen into the Seine long ago. The remains stuck out of the water in a rusted tangle of ancient steel.
"What about you, Jake?" Susanna asked.
"Hey, no problem," Jake said at once. He was actually smiling.
"I hate you, kid," Eddie said.
Roland was looking at Eddie with some concern.
"If you feel you can't do it, say so now. Don't get halfway across and then freeze up."
Eddie looked along the twisted surface of the bridge for a long time, then nodded.
"I guess I can handle it. Heights have never been my favorite thing, but I'll manage."
"Good." Roland surveyed them. "Soonest begun, soonest done. I'll go first with Susanna, then Jake and Eddie's drogue. Can you handle the wheelchair?"
"Hey, no problem," Eddie said giddily.
"Let's go then." Ten. As soon as he stepped onto the walkway, fear filled up Eddie's hollow places like cold water, and he began to wonder if he hadn't made a very dangerous mistake. From solid ground, the bridge seemed to be swaying only a little, but once he was actually on it, he felt as if he were standing on the pendulum of the world's biggest grandfather clock. The movement was very slow, but it was regular, and the length of the swings was much longer than he had anticipated. The walkway's surface was badly cracked and canted at least 10 degrees to the left. His feet gritted in loose piles of powdery concrete, and the low squealing sound of the box segments grinding together was constant. Beyond the bridge, the city skyline tilted slowly back and forth, like the artificial horizon of the world's slowest moving video game. Overhead, the wind hummed constantly in the taut hangars. Below, the ground fell away sharply to the muddy northwest bank of the river. He was 30 feet up, then 60, then 110. Soon he would be over the water. The wheelchair banged against his left leg with every step. Something furry brushed between his feet, and he clutched madly for the rusty handrail with his right hand, barely holding in a scream. Oi went trotting past him with a brief upward glance as if to say, "Excuse me, just passing."
"Fucking dumb animal," Eddie said through gritted teeth.
He discovered that although he didn't like looking down, he had an even greater aversion to looking at the hangars, which were still managing to hold the deck and the overhead cables together. They were sleeved with rust, and Eddie could see snarls of metal thread poking out of most. These snarls looked like metallic puffs of cotton. He knew from his Uncle Reg, who had worked on both the George Washington and Triborough bridges as a painter, that the hangers and overhead cables were spun from thousands of steel threads. On this bridge, the spin was finally letting go. The hangers were quite literally becoming unraveled, and as they did, the threads were snapping, one interwoven strand at a time.
"It's held this long, it'll hold a little longer. You think this thing's going to fall into the river just because you're crossing it? Don't flatter yourself."
He wasn't comforted, however. For all Eddie knew, they might be the first people to attempt the crossing in decades. And the bridge, after all, would have to collapse sometime. And from the look of things, it was going to be soon. Their combined weight might be the straw that broke the camel's back. His moccasin struck a chunk of concrete, and Eddie watched, sickened but helpless to look away, as the chunk fell down and down and down, turning over as it went. There was a small, very small, splash when it hit the river. The freshening wind gusted and stuck his shirt against his sweaty skin. The bridge groaned and swayed. Eddie tried to remove his hands from the side rail, but they seemed frozen to the pitted metal in a death grip. He closed his eyes for a moment.
"You're not going to freeze. You're not. I forbid it. If you need something to look at, make it long, tall, and ugly."
Eddie opened his eyes again, fixed them on the gunslinger, forced his hands to open, and began to move forward again. Eleven. Roland reached the gap and looked back. Jake was 5 feet behind him. Oi was at his heels. The bumbler was crouched down with his neck stretched forward. The wind was much stronger over the river cut, and Roland could see it rippling Oi's silky fur. Eddie was about 25 feet behind Jake. His face was tightly drawn, but he was still shuffling grimly along with Susanna's collapsed wheelchair in his left hand. His right was clutching the rail like grim death.
"Susanna?"
"Yes," she responded at once.
"Fine."
"Jake?" Jake looked up. He was still grinning, and the gunslinger saw there was going to be no problem there. The boy was having the time of his life. His hair blew back from his finely made brow in waves, and his eyes sparkled. He jerked one thumb up. Roland smiled and returned the gesture.
"Eddie?"
"Don't worry about me."
Eddie appeared to be looking at Roland, but the gunslinger decided he was really looking past him, at the windowless brick buildings which crowded the riverbank at the far end of the bridge. That was all right. Given his obvious fear of heights, it was probably the best thing he could do to keep his head.
"All right, I won't," Roland murmured.
"We're going to cross the hole now, Susanna. Sit easy. No quick movements. Understand?"
"Yes."
"If you want to adjust your position, do it now."
"I'm fine, Roland," she said calmly. "I just hope Eddie'll be all right."
"Eddie's a gunslinger now. He'll behave like one." Roland turned to the right so he was facing directly downriver and grasped the handrail. Then he began to edge out across the hole, shuffling his boots along the rusty cable. 12. Jake waited until Roland and Susanna were part of the way across the gap and then started himself. The wind gusted and the bridge swayed back and forth, but he felt no alarm at all. He was, in fact, totally buzzed. Unlike Eddie, he'd never had any fear of heights. He liked being up here, where he could see the river spread out like a steel ribbon under a sky which was beginning to cloud over. Halfway across the hole in the bridge, Roland and Susanna had reached the place where the uneven walkway resumed and were watching the others. Jake looked back, and his heart sank. They had forgotten one member of the party when they were discussing how to cross. Oi was crouched, frozen, and clearly terrified on the far side of the hole in the walkway. He was sniffing at the place where the concrete ended and the rusty, curved support took over.
"Come on, Oi!" Jake called.
"Oi!"
the bumbler called back, and the tremble in his hoarse voice was almost human. He stretched his long neck forward toward Jake, but didn't move. His gold-ringed eyes were huge and dismayed. Another gust of wind struck the bridge, making it sway and squall. Something twanged beside Jake's head, the sound of a guitar string which has been tightened until it snaps. A steel thread had popped out of the nearest vertical hanger, almost scratching his cheek. 10 feet away, Oi crouched miserably with his eyes fixed on Jake.
"Come on!" Roland shouted. "Wind's freshening! Come on, Jake!"
"Not without Oi!"
Jake began to shuffle back the way he had come. Before he had gone more than 2 steps, Oi stepped gingerly onto the support rod. The claws at the ends of his stiffly braced legs scratched at the rounded metal surface. Eddie stood behind the bumbler now, feeling helpless and scared to death.
"That's it, Oi," Jake encouraged. "Come to me."
"Oi, Oi, hey, Jake,"
the bumbler cried, and trotted rapidly along the rod. He had almost reached Jake when the traitorous wind gusted again. The bridge swung. Oi's claws scratched madly at the support rod for purchase, but there was none. His hindquarters slewed off the edge and into space. He tried to cling with his forepaws, but there was nothing to cling to. His rear legs ran wildly in midair. Jake let go of the rail and dived for him, aware of nothing but Oi's gold-ringed eyes.
"No, Jake!" Roland and Eddie bellowed together, each from his own side of the gap, each too far away to do anything but watch.
Jake hit the cable on his chest and belly. His pack bounced against his shoulder blades, and he heard his teeth click together in his head with the sound of a cue ball breaking a tight rack. The wind gusted again. He went with it, looping his right hand around the support rod and reaching for Oi with his left as he swayed out into space. The bumbler began to fall and clamped his jaws on Jake's reaching hand as he did. The pain was immediate and excruciating. Jake screamed but held on, head down, right arm clasping the rod, knees pressing hard against its wretchedly smooth surface. Oi dangled from his left hand like a circus acrobat, staring up with his gold-ringed eyes, and Jake could now see his own blood flowing along the sides of the bumbler's head in thin streams. Then the wind gusted again, and Jake began to slip outward. XIII. Eddie's fear left him. In its place came that strange yet welcome coldness. He dropped Susanna's wheelchair to the cracked cement with a clatter and raced nimbly out along the support cable, not even bothering with the handrail. Jake hung head down over the gap with Oi swinging at the end of his left hand like a furry pendulum, and the boy's right hand was slipping. Eddie opened his legs and seat dropped to a sitting position. His undefended ball smashed painfully up into his crotch, but for the moment even this exquisite pain was news from a distant country. He seized Jake by the hair with one hand and one strap of his pack with the other. He felt himself beginning to tilt outward, and for a nightmarish moment he thought all three of them were going to go over in a daisy chain. He let go of Jake's hair and tightened his grip on the pack strap, praying the kid hadn't bought the pack at one of the cheap discount outlets. He flailed above his head for the handrail with his free hand. After an interminable moment in which their combined outward slide continued, he found it and seized it.
"Roland," he bawled, "I could use a little help here."
But Roland was already there, with Susanna still perched on his back. When he bent, she locked her arms around his neck so she wouldn't drop headfirst from the sling. The gunslinger wrapped an arm around Jake's chest and pulled him up. When his feet were on the support rod again, Jake put his right arm around Oi's trembling body. His left hand was an agony of fire and ice.
"Let go, Oi," he gasped. "You can let go now. We're safe."
For a terrible moment he didn't think the Billy Bumbler would. Then, slowly, Oi's jaws relaxed, and Jake was able to pull his hand free. It was covered with blood and dotted with a ring of dark holes.
"Oi,"
the Bumbler said feebly, and Eddie saw with wonder that the animal's strange eyes were full of tears. He stretched his neck and licked Jake's face with his bloody tongue.
"That's okay,"
Jake said, pressing his face into the warm fur. He was crying himself, his face a mask of shock and pain.
"Don't worry, that's okay. You couldn't help it, and I don't mind."
Eddie was getting slowly to his feet. His face was dirty gray, and he felt as if someone had driven a bowling ball into his guts. His left hand stole slowly to his crotch and investigated the damage there.
"Cheap fucking vasectomy," he said hoarsely.
"Are you going to faint, Eddie?" Roland asked. A fresh gust of wind flipped his hat from his head and into Susanna's face. She grabbed it and jammed it down all the way to his ears, giving Roland the look of a half-crazed hillbilly.
"No," Eddie said. "I almost wish I could, but take a look at Jake," Susanna said. "He's really bleeding."
"I'm fine,"
Jake said, and tried to hide his hand. Roland took it gently in his own hands before he could. Jake had sustained at least a dozen puncture wounds in the back of his hand, his palm, and his fingers. Most of them were deep. It would be impossible to tell if bones had been broken or tendons severed until Jake tried to flex the hand. And this wasn't the time or place for such experiments. Roland looked at Oi. The Billy Bumbler looked back, his expressive eyes sad and frightened. He had made no effort to lick Jake's blood from his chops, although it would have been the most natural thing in the world for him to have done so.
"Leave him alone," Jake said, and wrapped the encircling arm more tightly about Oi's body. "It wasn't his fault. It was my fault for forgetting him. The wind blew him off."
"I'm not going to hurt him," Roland said. He was positive the Billy Bumbler wasn't rabid, but he still did not intend for Oi to taste any more of Jake's blood than he already had. As for any other diseases Oi might be carrying in his blood, well, Ka would decide, as in the end it always did. Roland pulled his neckerchief free and wiped Oi's lips and muzzle. "There," he said, "good fellow, good boy."
"Oi,"
the Billy Bumbler said feebly, and Susanna, who was watching over Roland's shoulder, could have sworn she heard gratitude in that voice. Another gust of wind struck them. The weather was turning dirty and fast. "Eddie, we have to get off the bridge. Can you walk?"
"No, massa. I's a gwine to shuffle."
The pain in his groin and the pit of his stomach was still bad, but not quite so bad as it had been a minute ago. "All right. Let's move, fast as we can." Roland turned, began to take a step, and stopped. A man was now standing on the far side of the gap, watching them expressionlessly. The newcomer had approached while their attention was focused on Jake and Oi. A crossbow was slung across his back. He wore a bright yellow scarf around his head, the ends streamed out like banners in the freshening wind. Gold hoops with crosses in their centers dangled from his ears. One eye was covered with a white silk patch. His face was blotched with purple sores, some of them open and festering. He might have been 30, 40, or 60. He held one hand high over his head. In it was something Roland could not make out, except that its shape was too regular to be a stone. Behind this apparition, the city loomed with a kind of weird clarity in the darkening day. As Eddie looked past the huddles of brick buildings on the other shore, warehouses long since scooped empty by looters, he had no doubt, and into those shadowy canyons and stone mazes, he understood for the first time how terribly mistaken, how terribly foolish his dreams of hope and help had been. Now he saw the shattered facades and broken roofs. Now he saw the shaggy bird's nests on cornices and in glassless, gaping windows. Now he allowed himself to actually smell the city. And that odor was not of fabulous spices and savory foods of the sort his mother had sometimes brought home from Zabar's, but rather the stink of a mattress that has caught fire, smoldered a while, and then been put out with sewer water. He suddenly understood Ludd, understood it completely. The grinning pirate who had appeared while their attention was elsewhere was probably as close to a wise old elf as this broken, dying place could provide. Roland pulled his revolver.
"Put it away, McKelly,"
the man in the yellow scarf said, in an accent so thick that the sense of his words was almost lost.
"Put it away, my dear heart. You're a fierce Trim, aye, that's clear, but this time you're outmatched."
14. The newcomer's pants were patched green velvet, and as he stood on the edge of the hole in the bridge, he looked like a buccaneer at the end of his days of plunder, sick, ragged, and still dangerous. "Suppose I choose not to," Roland asked. "Suppose I choose to simply put a bullet through your scrofulous head."
"Then I'll get to hell just enough ahead of ye to hold the door,"
the man in the yellow scarf said, and chuckled chummily. He wiggled the hand he held in the air.
"It's all the same jolly fake men to me, one way or t'other."
Roland guessed that was the truth. The man looked as if he might have a year to live at most, and the last few months of that year would probably be very unpleasant. The oozing sores on his face had nothing to do with radiation. Unless Roland was badly deceived, this man was in the late stages of what the doctors called mandrus and everyone else called whore's blossoms. Facing a dangerous man was always a bad business, but at least one could calculate the odds in such an encounter. When you were facing the dead, however, everything changed.
"Do you know what I've got here, my dear ones?" the pirate asked. "Do you ken what your old friend Gasher just happens to have laid his hands on?" "It's a grenado, something pretty the old folks left behind, and have already tipped its cap, for to wear one's cap before the introduction is complete would be very bad manners, so it would."
He cackled happily for a moment, and then his face grew still and grave once more. All humor left it, as if a switch had been turned somewhere in his degenerating brains.
"My finger's all that's holding the pin now, dearie. If you shoot me, there's going to be a very big bang. You and the cunt monkey on your back will be vaporized. The squint, too, I reckon. The young buck standing behind you and pointing that toy pistol in my face might live, but only till he hits the water. And hit it he would, 'cause this bridge has been hanging by thread these last 40 years, and all it'd take to finish it is one little push. So do you want to put away your iron, or should we all toddle off to hell on the same hand cart?"
Roland briefly considered trying to shoot the object Gasher called a grenado out of his hand, saw how tightly the man was gripping it, and holstered his gun.
"Ah, good!" Gasher cried, cheerful once more. "I knew you was a trig cove just looking at you. Oh, yes, so I did."
"What do you want?" Roland asked, although he thought he already knew this, too. Gasher raised his free hand and pointed a dirty finger at Jake.
"The squint. Give me the squint, and the rest of you go free."
"Go fuck yourself," Susanna said at once.
"Why not?" the pirate cackled. "Give me a chunk of mirror, and I'll rip it right off and stick it right in. Why not, for all the good it's a-doing me these days? Why, I can't even run water through it without it burns me all the way to the top of my gully wash."
His eyes, which were a strange, calm shade of gray, never left Roland's face.
"What do you say, my good old mate?"
"What happens to the rest of us if I hand over the boy?"
"Why, you go on your way without no trouble from us," the man in the yellow head scarf returned promptly. "You have the TikTok man's word on that. It comes from his lips to my lips to your ears, so it does. And TikTok's a trade cove, too, but don't break his word once it's been given. I can't say every word nor watch about any pubes you might run into, but you'll have no trouble with the TikTok man's grays."
"What the fuck are you saying, Roland?" Eddie roared. "You're not really thinking about doing it, are you?"
Roland didn't look down at Jake, and his lips didn't move as he murmured, "I'll keep my promise."
"Yes, I know you will."
Then Jake raised his voice and said, "Put the gun away, Eddie. I'll decide."
"Jake, you're out of your mind!"
The pirate cackled cheerily.
"Not at all, Cully. You're the one who's lost his mind, if you disbelieve me. At the very least, he'll be safe from the drums with us, won't he? And just think, if I didn't mean what I say, I would have told you to toss your guns overside first thing, easiest thing in the world. But did I? Nay!"
Susanna had heard the exchange between Jake and Roland. She had also had a chance to realize how bleak their options were as things now stood.
"Put it away, Eddie."
"How do we know you won't toss the grenade at us once you have the kid?" Eddie called.
"I'll shoot it out of the air if he tries," Roland said. "I can do it, and he knows I can do it."
"Mayhap I do. You got a cozy look about you, indeed you do."
"If he's telling the truth," Roland went on, "he'd be burned even if I missed his toy, because the bridge would collapse and we'd all go down together."
"Very clever, my dear old son," Gasher said. "You are a cozy one, ain't you?"
He cawed laughter, then grew serious and confiding.
"The talking's done, old mate of mine. Decide. Will you give me the boy, or do we all march to the end of the path together?"
Before Roland could say a word, Jake had slipped past him on the support rod. He still held Oi curled in his right arm. He held his bloody left hand stiffly out in front of him.
"Jake, no!"
Eddie shouted desperately. "I'll come for you," Roland said in the same low voice.
"I know,"
Jake repeated. The wind gusted again. The bridge swayed and groaned. The sand was now speckled with whitecaps, and water boiled whitely around the wreck of the Blue Mono jutting from the river on the upstream side.
"Aye, McCully," Gasher crooned. His lips spread wide, revealing a few remaining teeth that jutted from his white gums like decayed tombstones. "Ah, my fine young squint, just keep coming."
"Roland, he could be bluffing," Eddie yelled. "That thing could be a dud."
The gunslinger made no reply. As Jake neared the other side of the hole in the walkway, Oi bared his own teeth and began to snarl at Gasher.
"Toss that talking bag of guts overside," Gasher said.
"Fuck you,"
Jake replied in the same calm voice. The pirate looked surprised for a moment, then nodded.
Tender of him, are you? Very well.
He took two steps backward.
Put him down the second you reach the concrete, then, and if he runs at me, I promise to kick his brains right out his tender little asshole.
Asshole, Oi said through his bared teeth.
Shut up, Oi, Jake muttered. He reached the concrete just as the strongest gust of wind yet struck the bridge. This time the twanging sound of parting cable strands seemed to come from everywhere. Jake glanced back and saw Roland and Eddie clinging to the rail. Susanna was watching him from over Roland's shoulder, her tight cap of curls rippling and shaking in the wind. Jake raised his hand to them. Roland raised his in return.
"You won't let me drop this time?" he had asked.
"No, not ever again," Roland had replied. Jake believed him, but he was very much afraid of what might happen before Roland arrived. He put Oi down. Gasher rushed forward the moment he did, kicking out at the small animal. Oi skittered aside, avoiding the booted foot.
"Run!" Jake shouted.
Oi did, shooting past them and loping toward the lud end of the bridge with his head down, swerving to avoid the holes and leaping across the cracks in the pavement. He didn't look back. A moment later, Gasher had his arm around Jake's neck. He stank of dirt and decaying flesh, the two odors combining to create a single deep stench, crusty and thick. It made Jake's gorge rise. He bumped his crotch into Jake's buttocks.
"Maybe I ain't quite so far gone as I thought. Don't they say youth's the wine what makes old men drunk? We'll have us a time, won't we, my sweet little squint? I will have a time such as will make the angels sing."
"Oh, Jesus," Jake thought.
Gasher raised his voice again.
"We're leaving now, my hard case friend. We have grand things to do and grand people to see, so we do, but I keep my word. As for you, you'll stand right where you are for a good 15 minutes if you're wise. If I see you start to move, we're all going to ride the hansom. Do you understand me?"
"Yes," Roland said.
"Do you believe me when I say I have nothing to lose?"
"Yes."
"That's very well, then. Move, boy. Up."
Gasher's hold tightened on Jake's throat until he could hardly breathe. At the same time, he was pulled backward. They retreated that way, facing the gap where Roland stood with Susanna on his back and Eddie just behind him, still holding the Ruger, which Gasher had called a toy pistol. Jake could feel Gasher's breath puffing against his ear in hot little blurts. Worse, he could smell it.
"Don't try a fang," Gasher whispered, "or I'll rip off your sweetmeats and stuff 'em up your bung. And it would be sad to lose 'em before you ever got a chance to use 'em, wouldn't it? Very sad indeed."
They reached the end of the bridge. Jake stiffened, believing Gasher would throw the grenade anyway, but he didn't, at least not immediately. He backed Jake through a narrow alley between two small cubicles which had probably served as toll booths once upon a time. Beyond them, the brick warehouses loomed like prison cell blocks.
"Now, Kelly, I'm going to let go your neck, or how would you ever have wind to run with? But I'll be holding your arm, and if you don't run like the wind, I promise I'll rip it right off and use it for a club to beat you with. You understand?"
Jake nodded, and suddenly the terrible, stifling pressure was gone from his windpipe. As soon as it was, he became aware of his hand again. It felt hot and swollen and full of fire. Then Gasher seized his bicep with fingers like bands of iron, and he forgot all about his hand.
"Toodle-doo!"
Gasher called in a grotesquely cheery falsetto. He waggled the grenade at the others.
"Bye-bye, dears."
Then he growled to Jake, "Now run, you horned little squint, run!" Jake was first whirled and then yanked into a run. The two of them went flying down a curved ramp to street level. Jake's first confused thought was that this was what the East River Drive would look like 200 or 300 years after some weird brain plague had killed all the sane people in the world. The ancient rusty hulks of what had once surely been automobiles stood at intervals along both curbs. Most were bubble-shaped roadsters that looked like no cars Jake had ever seen before,
except maybe for the ones the white-gloved creations of Walt Disney drove in the comic books, but among them he saw an old Volkswagen Beetle, a car that might have been a Chevrolet Corvair, and something he believed was a Model A Ford. There were no tires on any of these eerie hulks. They'd either been stolen or had rotted away to dust long since. And all the glass had been broken, as if the remaining denizens of this city abhorred anything which might show them their own reflections, even accidentally. Beneath and between the abandoned cars, the